Hello, everybody. Josh Brown here, and I am thrilled to be back this week with an interview. I was on a bit of a hiatus from interviews. My wife just gave birth to our beautiful second daughter, Naomi, and both are doing extremely well. And I am thrilled to be back today with an interview with Michael E. Gerber, Mr. E-Myth himself. And we just have a fascinating discussion really on the psychology of entrepreneurship. And I love so many things about this interview, one of which is I came to the interview with a bunch of questions that I was planning on asking. And the conversation really dives into areas that I hadn't even really thought about, but it just makes for a very, very fascinating and incredible conversation with the legend himself. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this interview with Michael Gerber.
Have you ever thought of buying a franchise or currently own one or many? If so, this podcast is for you. Welcome to Franchise Euphoria, the podcast created and hosted by franchise attorney Josh Brown for the sole purpose of helping people find success through franchising.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Franchise Euphoria, the podcast to help you find success through franchising. Today, I am simply thrilled to have Mr. Michael E. Gerber on the show. Mr. Gerber is a very well-known author, speaker, coach, entrepreneurial guru, and quite frankly, the king of systems and systems implementation to help make small businesses efficient, effective, practical, and most importantly, profitable. He is widely known for his best-selling E-Myth books that are like Bibles to small businesses and their owners. I could go on and on, as Mr. Gerber has done so many wonderful and incredible things on his journey, but instead I will stop and let you hear from the man himself. Hello, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Josh. How are you today?
I'm doing fabulous. And yourself?
Wonderful. I understand you're freezing your butt off there in Indiana.
Exactly. Aside from that, but I am recording this inside, luckily. So
that's good. That's good. I would have recommended that in any case.
So I do have, it's nice and toasty in my office. So that's nice. Well, before we dive in, you know, I'd just like to reiterate what a thrill it is to be speaking with you. It was about 10 years ago when a dear friend of mine, and he's a client now and a friend, and he was just getting started in his own entrepreneurial journey. And he basically started a company from scratch, and now it does upwards of 30, 40 million a year. And we were talking on the phone one day, and he said, "Oh, I'm just reading all these incredible entrepreneurial books." And I said, "Really? Well, tell me about that, because I'm kind of curious about that." And he was telling me about a number of books. He said, "But by far, the best one I've ever read is E-Myth." And I said, "The what?" And he said, "It's E-Myth Revisited, Michael Gerber." And he said, "Just trust me, Josh, this will change your life and your thinking. Go read it." So I went, I bought it, I read it, and I got to tell you, he was absolutely right. And as of today, I have read it and reread it several times over. So I just want to say thank you for putting that book together.
Well, thank your friend, Josh, and thank you. And of course, I hear it a lot, but you understand that I can never hear it enough. Because when somebody truly understands what underlies the book, what's behind the book, the experience that drove me to write the book, and the understanding that I had to internalize in order to be able to communicate the story in the book, then you first and truly begin to understand why I'm so passionate about it.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you know, that's a great touching off point here. I mean, you know, as you know, from us briefly talking before we recorded, you know, my audience is filled with dreamers. You know, these are people who have been stuck in corporate America, dying for a way out. You know, these are recently laid off corporate executives, and small business owners that dream of growing their businesses, and entrepreneurs that just dream of getting started. And, you know, what I'm trying to do is help these people realize their dreams by educating them, helping to educate them so that they don't make foolish mistakes when it comes to franchising. That's really the why of what I do. And I'm kind of curious, what was your why when you set out to create eMyth?
Well, candidly, it was simply an invitation by a friend of mine to come visit a client of his. I was on to my way to doing something completely other than that. But he was so persuasive and I was so naive, I said, sure. So I went to visit his client, who had difficulty turning the leads that my friend's advertising agency created for his high-tech firm. And so my friend asked if I would help. And I went to meet the guy, not knowing anything about high-tech firms. And candidly, not knowing anything about business, because I wasn't interested in business, went there simply as a lark, you might say. So I sat down with this guy, and I've told this story before, so anybody listening in says, oh, Gerber, you've told that story so many times. You got to understand that it is one of those core essential stories that have to be told for anybody to truly understand how they get where they are. Because I didn't go there to get something. I went there simply as a favor to someone. And I had two assumptions when I started this meeting with my friend's client, call him Bob, who is the founder and CEO of this high-tech firm in Silicon Valley. And I had these two assumptions. One, I don't know anything about business, because I knew I didn't. And two, Bob does, because he owns one. So lo and behold, as I begin this conversation with Bob, I'm beginning with both of those assumptions. So what can I do? Well, Bob asked me, what do you know about my business? Nothing, Bob. Bob asked me, what do you know about my products? Absolutely nothing, Bob. So how can you help me? I haven't a clue. But we've got an hour to kill, so let's see what happens. And so I began by asking him questions. It's all I could do. Ask questions, just like you're asking me questions. And the more I asked these questions, the more my assumptions were turned on their ear. First of all, I discovered that I did know something about business. I knew that selling is a system. And of course, every business needs to sell something if it's going to survive, let alone grow. And secondly, what I also realized is that Bob didn't know that. Bob didn't know that selling is a system. And because Bob didn't know that selling is a system, Bob went out and made the first mistake every single person makes when they create a business. They go out to hire somebody who does know how to sell. They go to get somebody with experience. Now, that's the most commonly logical thing to do. Get somebody who knows how to do it. The problem is, because no entrepreneur in his right mind would ever do it that way, no franchisor in his right mind would ever do it that way, most people who go into business aren't really who we think they are. They're not entrepreneurs at all. They're what I've come to call, after all of the experience I've gained over the past 40 years, is technicians suffering from an entrepreneurial seizure. So they create a job for themselves. And when they are forced to get somebody else to do it, they go out to get somebody with experience. They never, ever, ever build a system to do it. And because they don't build a system to do it, they can't scale it. Well, so that's what I discovered in that meeting with Bob. I discovered that there was no selling system there, and I set about the task of creating one. And he was my first client. So all of a sudden, unlike you, I'm sitting over here doing something else, and now I'm over here doing something else. I didn't decide that's what I was there to do. It just happened.
What were you doing prior to that meeting?
What was I doing? Josh, what I'd been doing just prior to that meeting, I was learning how to frame a house. Meaning I had made a decision, this romantic, absolutely extraordinary decision, that rather than making a living with my mouth, meaning rather than selling, rather than doing what I was accustomed to doing, I was going to go out and work with my hands. And I was going to learn how to do something completely different. And so I absolutely did that. I went down the street knocking on doors to get a job to become a framer. I didn't know it was a framer then because I didn't know anything about what I was going to do other than I was going to build houses. Now, think about this. I wasn't a kid. I wasn't 12 years old. I was 38.
Wow.
So I went to work for finally, ultimately, the guy who finally hired me, and the only reason he hired me is because my mother convinced him to. Hear me, I'm 38 years old. Her friends are saying, what's Michael doing? And she would say, he's discovering himself. So you understand what I was a wandering Jew. I was a philosopher. I was a poet. I was a saxophone player. I was an encyclopedia salesman. I was this. I was that. I was everything and anything and nothing, looking for the truth, looking for the Holy Grail. And that's what showed up on this guy's doorstep.
You and I both, Michael, were both MOT. I said you and I both were both MOT, members of the tribe.
Yes, that's what we are, members of the tribe. The tribe. That's another whole story. Let's not talk about that.
Yeah. Well, that is, you know, that's so fascinating to me because, you know, I talk to a lot of people, as I know you do, who, you know, they feel like they have to come before they can start something, they have to have experience in something, right? They feel like they have to know it before they can begin. And a lot of times people run away from their natural drawn talents or their natural given talent. I mean, for you, anybody who spends 2 minutes listening to one of your speeches or talks with you knows you have a talent for speaking, you know, a talent for selling. So the idea that you would go frame houses obviously sounds crazy, right? Why is it that people run away from what they're really born to do?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because I'm in this, in the throes of, in fact, writing exactly what you're talking about. The question is, why is it that people, in fact, rather than doing what they are gifted to do, people do what is safe to do. They become entrained to do it. And they do that out of fear. Now, most people would believe that they do that out of desire, meaning they have a passion. Very few people start anything with a passion for it. If we look at everybody who's employed today in these United States of America, if you were to actually go down the street knocking on doors and talking to all of those people, you and I would discover that most of those people hate their job. Most of those people, even if they're very, very good at their job, hate their job. On the other hand, once you discover that, you're going to discover something else. And you're going to discover that, in fact, very, very, very few of those people are truly creative, truly innovative. In fact, it's been trained out of them. Being creative, being innovative, being what Walt Disney calls an Imagineer is completely the opposite of what we have been inspired to do from the moment we were kids, because being creative creates chaos. You understand, we've been trained entrained, I might say, to become enslaved to safe.
Yes, yeah.
And so as we become entrained to safe, meaning to do what's safe, to do what's accepted, to do what's ordinary, to do what's going to provide us with this safety net for the rest of our lives, to get a career, and so forth and so forth and so forth, all that stuff. In fact, we've been entrained away from being inspired. And so we become consumers rather than creators. And that's why most people do what they do, to become fully ingrained consumers in a culture in which we are trained to consume. It's good to consume. It's not only good to consume, it's great to consume. And so we become consumers, and we've been entrained away from being creators. So I'm, in fact, and have always been an outsider. No matter what I was doing, no matter how I was doing it, this lunatic on the outside of the inside, always doing something which was completely the opposite of what one, in quotes, as intelligent as you, Michael, would do. Now, what is it? What's that unnatural, I'll call it, urge to do the opposite of what, in fact, is good and reasonable and sensible and practical and worthwhile to do, which is safe to do? So that is what moved me to get to the point where I found myself in front of Bob. And suddenly I'm inspired by what's missing in this picture, what's missing in Bob's business, what's missing in Bob's mind, to come to the realization that the world is unlike anything I had imagined it to be. But if I were not an outsider, meaning completely insane, completely unsafe, whatever you can call it, I never would have seen it. I never would have seen Bob's problem. I never would have written the E-Myth. I never would have created what I've created since that time. And that's what I'm saying is missing in this picture. With every single person you're speaking to, you, Josh, as a coach, as a thought leader, as a facilitator, as a educator, as a teacher, as a whatever it is that you are, that's what's missing in the picture of the people that you're speaking to. And so the interesting thing when you say, you know, dreamers, my people are dreamers, I'm going to suggest a slant to that, that you may not be aware of, or you may very well be aware of, but we don't know each other very well, so how could we possibly know? And that is that they're not dreamers at all. If they're doing dreaming, it's a personal dream. It has to do with getting. In other words, it has to do with getting more than what they've got.
Yeah.
It has to do with experiencing more than what they're experiencing. And I'm suggesting that, in fact, true dreamers have, in fact, no inclination to pursue a personal dream, but rather, as we call it in what I've created, the Dreaming Room, which is an incubator for entrepreneurs, in fact, an impersonal dream. It's not about me, it's about them. True entrepreneurs are moved by a condition which exists without them, without or outside of them, that somebody else is stuck with. In short, they see a problem that's waiting to be solved. They see a condition that is waiting to be transformed. They see a person who isn't living to his fullest. They see a problem that, in fact, is waiting for resolution.
I mean, do you think that these entrepreneurs, I mean, do you think that entrepreneurs are born, or can they be made?
Well, it's a great question, and I'm writing about that as well in the work that I'm doing.
I had no idea you were writing on any of this stuff. Yeah. It's just stuff I'm interested in.
But I believe we're born with the natural capability to create. I believe we're born with the instinct to create. I believe we're born with the desire to create. I believe we're born with the passion to invent. But what I also believe is that we're not born with the skills to do that. And that, in fact, from the moment we're born, every influence that prevails in our emerging lives is essentially flying against that part of ourselves, because creativity creates conflict. Creativity creates conflict with the powers that be. Creativity creates confusion. And every kid is just that, just, you know, this troubling influence on order. Creativity creates disorder. And that's what's so extraordinary about it. But it's, what do you call it? It's killed in most of us at the very beginning.
Yeah, because we're taught to follow a certain path, right? We're just, as you talked about, we were taught. I'm wondering what you think. I mean, I see, you know, at least with my generation and some of the younger, you know, people coming up, I see a momentum shift going the other way. I see where there's a lot of people, because it's affected so many people with the economy, the downturn, people losing their jobs, that there's this movement out there. And I'm curious your thoughts on this, where people are starting to realize that what they once thought was safe was really not safe. You know, in my opinion, the safest thing you can do is bet on yourself, invest in yourself in terms of you're not safe going to your corporate job, because you never know when that Friday is going to come at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when your boss comes over to you and says, sorry, we're making cutbacks. I've seen that in so many people who have followed the quote unquote safe path just to find themselves out of a job. And yet their mentality has been so framed over a number of years of being in that environment that they just don't even know what to do. And, you know, when you talk to them, you realize they have so many transferable skills, but they don't know where to go. So I'm just kind of curious, do you see a momentum shift where, there's a lot of people are realizing that what was once thought of as safe is really not safe?
Well, it's been said that in the worst of times, the best of times, the best of times, the worst of times, the reality is, as we look out at the economic chaos that exists around us, and we could have a lengthy conversation about that, but we can all agree upon one thing, that there is economic chaos around us. Everything that was certain isn't any longer. When you have a $17 trillion deficit, and no one listening to us right now can appreciate, in fact, how disastrous that is. When we have a $90 trillion unfunded debt, and nobody can understand how impossible that is to overcome. When we see the nature of work today in our country, and forget about the rest of the world, I'm just talking about the US of A. When we look at the nature of unemployment in this country, when we look at all of the conditions that we're all born into and have to deal with, when we look at the impossible college debt, over $1 trillion in college debt and growing, with no ability to pay it off, When we put all of that together, we understand that, in fact, everybody you're talking about, yes, is devastated by the conditions which surround them, but they have been entrained to believe in stuff that isn't true. So, in fact, when you say your best resource is yourself, well, that's true if I even knew what to do with that resource. We've got no place to go to do anything with that resource other than to learn a new skill. And that new skill is up for grabs. How do we choose? What do we elect to do? So in effect, I'm saying that, yes, all of the grounding is there for something remarkable to happen. But unfortunately, the institutions that exist aren't addressing it in an original, innovative way. They're addressing it in exactly the way we got to where we are, only different. Something other than exactly the same but different has got to be done, because exactly the same but different is not going to transform the experience all of these young people have coming out of stupid school, going on to stupid jobs, or just running around in the street screaming with their clothes off. Something other than that has to happen.
Well, how do people?
That's the work.
Yeah, how do the young people who are coming out of these schools or who are bypassing the schools, how do they awaken themselves? You know, how do they go out to seek what their own sort of, you know, a lot of what you talk about, I feel like touches upon, you know, both spiritual and practical, not spiritual from a religious perspective, but just spiritual from the perspective of knowing yourself, of finding yourself and being able to understand. I mean, your dreaming room that you've created and a lot of the things that you've done. And I'm kind of curious what kind of recommendations or advice you would have for those young people out there, or it doesn't really matter if they're young or old, but those people who are searching, you know, what is a viable action or step that they can take to help get them one step closer to what they ultimately want to accomplish?
Well, there, you know, that's a question with a very, very lengthy answer. So let me say that, in fact, the people you're describing are doing significantly less searching than you would imagine. They are looking around, but they're not searching. So, you know, the searching that one might have said happened in the 50s and the 60s, the searching that is at the core of some of the really, really profound books that have been written about searching, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, et cetera, and so forth, the searching, that searching in the truest sense of the word, the spiritual searching, the searching for some holy grail, some truth, something essential, something that, in fact, I could put my life into. That kind of searching isn't going on. Right now, there's a lot of noise. And the noise, unfortunately, is reflected in the things that we buy and the things that we do. I said we're not creators, we're consumers. And so we're breeding a whole batch of consumer-centric kids. Buy stuff. Do stuff that you buy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, in fact, what's, you know, happening all around us is that our machines are becoming more human and our humans are becoming more mechanical. So ultimately, in the book Singularity, I'm sure you know about it, mm-hmm. it suggests that evolution of man is really going to become a combination of man and machine. That our machines can do things that human beings are incapable of doing. And as our machines can do things that people are incapable of doing, people are going to let go of their innate capacity to learn to do those things in deference to the machine. Why? Because it's so much easier. My machine can do that for me. My machine can do that for me. And so in the process of that, and because we're not truly searching, we're buying, we're hoping, what in fact is occurring is exactly the opposite of what we would hope to happen, that we become more human, that we discover more what in fact it means to be human. And so I'm suggesting, in fact, that there is a model, or if you will, an opportunity for people to become more human, to discover what I think of as the creator within. That if we're born in the image of God, or you can call it the universe, you can call it great mind, you can call it spirit, you can call whatever people are comfortable calling God. If we're born in the image of God, we are here and we are born to create. And that becomes then the path that every single one of us should be taking from the very beginning. From the very beginning, at the moment we're born, to create, and to in fact learn how to create is the most important thing that in fact we could ever do for any of these kids. And so that's what my work is now. My work now is awakening the entrepreneur, the creator within. And in fact, that's the most important work I believe we can do on Earth. And I don't believe anybody is doing it to the degree that it's waiting to be done. But that's what I'm setting out to do at this young age, of course, of 77.
Well, you know, 77 is the new 47, right?
What can I tell you?
No, I think that's fantastic. So you have it sounds like you have a book coming out that's going to touch upon that, or a couple books.
Well, my book, Awakening the Entrepreneur Within, I don't know if you've read it, but if you haven't, you should. Awakening the Entrepreneur Within, How Ordinary People Can Create Extraordinary Companies, and the subquote to the subquote, Without Any Experience to Guide Them. And it's an introduction to the Dreaming Room. And the Dreaming Room is an introduction to yourself. The Dreaming Room is an entrepreneurial incubator. The product of the Dreaming Room is not a startup, meaning not a business. The product of the Dreaming Room is born out of my mantra, which is the startup is you. Meaning until you awaken the true entrepreneur within you, I don't care what you do, it will end up disappointing you.
I love that. I think that's fantastic. Yeah, and I was aware of that book. I did. Yeah, I just didn't know if you had a if you had something coming up on the horizon.
It's called The 5 Essential Skills of Extraordinary People, and those 5 essential skills are core to entrepreneurship, to creativity, to innovation, to becoming what I think of as an independent-minded person. And so what we must create are independent-minded people, not dependent-minded people. Because it's independent-minded people who in fact discover what is missing in this picture for just about everybody. How is it that Steve Jobs saw and was able to create what Steve Jobs saw and was able to create in a world in which no one else had created it?
I think that's so interesting. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a question that crosses so many people's mind. I mean, you know, as we all set out on our own entrepreneurial journeys, I mean, I think we all have sort of visions or at least thoughts about where we'd like to go. And, you know, what separates those, you know, the Steve Jobs of the world, the Walt Disneys of the world, and so on and so forth, from everyone else. I mean, I think that's absolutely fascinating. I mean, boy, I've enjoyed talking to you so much, and we have been talking for 33 minutes now. It is just, it has flown by. And I would be remiss, though, being that I have the Franchise Euphoria podcast, to let you get off the phone before we talk just a couple minutes about franchising. Do you have a couple more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Basically what I wanted to, you know, I fell in love with the idea of franchising. It was really several years ago, but I didn't realize it until a few years ago, if that makes sense. You know, speaking of Steve Jobs, I love his quote where it says, you know, something to the effect of, you know, you cannot connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking back. And for me, nothing has been truer. I mean, before I went to law school, I worked for 5 years in business. And for some of those years, I helped a couple different franchise owner operators grow their business. And so I learned sort of the ins and outs of the franchise world from a business perspective. And then when I became an attorney and was practicing and decided that I really enjoyed working with small businesses, I was looking to sort of niche myself, and I thought about franchising. And the thing when I really thought about that I loved for me about franchising was that at its core, the franchise model is all about systems and processes. And whether or not you are buying a franchise, whether or not you want to turn your business into a franchise, or whether you're just a small business that just wants to run as an independent small business, the systems and processes that you put in place are going to make or break you. And that's what really drove me to the franchise model. I'm curious what you found, what drove you to the franchise model and being such a proponent of it.
Well, it was so obvious. When at the very beginning, after I met with Bob, and then I went to work with Bob as a consultant to build his selling system, and then I worked with another client of my buddy's ad agency, and then a third, and then a fourth, and then a fifth. As I began to do that work, it became obvious that every single one of these owners of these client companies had done pretty much the same thing. It was like they went to the store, they bought a jigsaw puzzle, they went back to their business, opened the box, tossed all the pieces on the floor, and threw away the cover to the box. In essence, there was absolutely no picture of where they were going or what this would look like when it got done. So I realized there was no vision. There was simply guys working, busting their buns, trying to get the job done. And so I went to work, as I called it later, on their business to help them to go to work on their business rather than in their business. I had to extract them from their business in order to awaken what I then later knew to be the entrepreneur. And as I was doing this business after business after business, for whatever reason, I walked into McDonald's between one meeting and another, and I walked in for a hamburger, and I walked out with a vision. I instantly saw what was missing in every single one of my client companies. Ray Kroc invented McDonald's. Well, he didn't invent it, he found it. The McDonald brothers invented McDonald's, he improved upon it. But essentially, he understood the logic of McDonald's, that effectively, the system is the solution. The system is the way in which McDonald's brand is explicated in the most extraordinarily, exquisitely effective and efficient manner in the hands of ordinary people, to produce a stunningly consistent result again and again and again. And I realized in that moment that what was missing in this picture with all these independent business owners is that they didn't go to work on their business, to invent a franchise prototype, which is what Ray Kroc had to do, in order to scale it. And that whether or not, as you said, they wanted to franchise it, absolutely, they had to do identically the same thing. Didn't matter that it was an independent business. It had to become a franchise, meaning it had to become a system that could be replicated faithfully in the hands of ordinary people. And in order to do that, you'd have to build it differently than every single independent business is built on the face of this earth. So I saw it clearly way back then in the 70s. And as I saw that, it became obvious to me very, very shortly afterward that nobody had ever done this that way. And so we set about creating our first business, the Michael Thomas Corporation, which I called a business development firm with Michael and Thomas. I was Michael, he was Thomas, to create what I call the McDonald's of small business consulting. And we set about to build a consulting system unlike anything that had ever been built before that I could put into the hands of a minimum wage kid, my consultant, which in fact was a coach. So we built the first business coaching company way back then in 1977 and set about the task of replicating it. So not only did we do this for our clients, but we did this for ourselves. And in effect, it drove the whole e-myth lexicon, the whole e-myth paradigm, the whole e-myth perspective from the very beginning. So what's most distressing to me about franchising is when franchising doesn't do what, in fact, Ray Kroc set out and then so exquisitely did to build the most successful small business on the face of this earth, McDonald's. What they do instead is to believe it's about the people. It's about the franchisee. The franchisee's got to be an entrepreneur. Well, no franchisee should be an entrepreneur, because if in fact a franchisee is an entrepreneur, then he or she is going to start by changing whatever system happens to be there to suit themselves. And therefore, it's not scalable. And therefore, the whole idea of a franchise goes down the tubes.
Yeah, absolutely. I counsel with people about that all the time where, you know, it's so important, you know, for people to realize their own personalities before they ever decide to buy a franchise. I am amazed at the number of people that go and buy a franchise and then they're disgruntled thereafter. And when you sit and you talk to them, you find out, wait, you're the type of entrepreneur that should have started the franchise, not bought the franchise.
Right. You need to be a manager when you buy a franchise. The perfect franchisee is in fact an incredibly skilled manager with an incredibly skilled management system that enables him or her to manage the system that has been given them by license by the franchisor. So the very first thing that, in quotes, franchise manager needs to do before they ever buy a franchise is to absolutely make certain that the system is in place and the system works in place. And then what they're doing is they're buying the capability to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, it sounds so simple, right? But I'm amazed at the number of people that get it wrong. And it goes both ways. I mean, you know, the franchisor has a responsibility to make sure that they're put good franchisees in, and the franchisees have a responsibility to themselves to do so as well. And I'm really glad we were able to touch upon that at the end. And I feel like I could talk to you for an entire day, but I know you've got other things going on.
I do have some other things to
do. I so appreciate your time. And before we go, though, I'd love for, you know, take a moment and let people know whatever it is, you know, you've got exciting going on for 2014 and beyond. And then, you know, how people can get a hold of you or learn more about your companies.
Well, the most important thing we're doing today is to spread the Dreaming Room worldwide. So I have a master licensee in Australia, New Zealand, a master licensee in Japan, in Canada, in the UK. And I'm working with our master licensees, building out the prototype, ready to scale it worldwide. The Dreaming Room is exactly what I've said. It is the incubator that has never been created before. An incubator to awaken an entrepreneurial personality to the point where they absolutely are clear about their dream, their vision, their purpose, and their mission. And those four outcomes, those four competencies, those four drivers of a company are absolutely critical because they're the keynotes of each of the four personalities within an entrepreneur. The first is the dreamer, the second is the thinker, the third is the storyteller, and the fourth is the leader. And if anybody wants to find out more about all that, which I just shared with you, would love to join a Dreaming Room, which everybody can do. We can do that with anybody, anywhere on the face of this earth, through Zoom, online, led by one of my master facilitators. All you need to do is to contact me, Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, at michaelegerber.com. And when you contact me, I'll make certain you can get into the very next Dreaming Room. And the beauty of it is it's a 36-hour process done in 1 3-hour intensive each consecutive week for 12 consecutive weeks, led by a Dreaming Room facilitator. And the cost is only $2,995. Now think about that, creating a platform for growth that every single original person who goes through this creates on their own. In short, we don't tell you what your dream is, you discover it.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. I feel like I could have a whole nother show just on your Dreaming Room. And no, that just sounds incredible. And I you know, I just think you are a visionary. In the truest sense of the word, completely ahead of your time, and just so thankful that you've spent some moments with me on this show today. So thank you again, Michael.
Thank you, Josh. I love the spirit of your questions, and please, let's do it again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us today on the Franchise Euphoria podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to go to iTunes and provide a review. Also, please remember that although Josh Brown is a licensed and practicing attorney, nothing contained in this podcast should be construed as legal advice, because it is not. The information contained in this podcast is general and educational in nature, and none of it should be relied upon as legal advice. That being said, if you have questions for Josh and would like to contact him, please email him at josh@franchiseeuphoria.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you tune in to our next weekly episode.